morning, and thank you for tuning in to KBOO Community Radio and to Political Perspectives. I'm your host today, Linda Olson Osterlund. I'm very happy to be doing this program today. I'm getting to interview for the third time, I believe, William Arkin. He is a very interesting man to start with. I looked up his bio and that kind of things on Wikipedia, always a quick source, not always quite so accurate, but it's 2 pages long. And it's not the bio part, it's the work part. And this is because William Arkin started out as a, as Army intelligence. But when he came out of the Army, that was in 74 to 78, he authored 4 volumes of the Nuclear Weapons Data Book, a series for the National Resources Defense Council, and a reference on books on nuclear weapons. Well, he also, in a way, if he had been inside the Army, he'd be called a whistleblower. He also was a true investigative journalist, and he one of his discoveries was of top secret U.S. plans to secretly move nuclear weapons to a number of overseas locations. After that, he worked with Greenpeace and the Human Rights Watch on the issue of cluster bombs in the first Gulf War. He went on to work with other organizations like the Institute for Policy Studies, and the Center for Defense Information. You know, I couldn't list all of the different organizations he worked for. And he became a journalist with many different organizations. The one we most know about is NBC News. He's been with them off and on, maybe for almost 30 years. He's also worked for The Guardian, for for Washington Post. He's also, really interestingly, been an advisor to the Secretary of Defense, the Office of the CIA, the Office of Chief Naval Operations, Naval Intelligence, the United States Air Force. And he is the author of a book called Top Secret, The Rise of the New American Security State. And this is what I interviewed him about first. And this is when we first found out, the truth about the growing national security state, the homeland security, et cetera. And it was a very important book, and that's why I bothered to interview him. Well, his most recent, he's hit the news. He's continued to be a reporter through all of this, or more than a reporter, an analyst, a consultant, a deep investigative journalist through all of this time. And most recently, in January, he chose to resign from NBC, who he'd worked with for many years as an analyst and a consultant and a reporter. And his letter to his colleagues, he wrote a very moving letter to his colleagues on his resignment, on him resigning from NBC. And that letter became very famous, known as the Perpetual War Letter. Many of you who listen to KBOO also listen to our, when we put on Democracy Now!, and you may have heard an interview about this back in January. So we're going to talk to him today about this letter and why he left NBC and what he feels is a problem with media today. And we'll use specifics about types of coverage, including Korea, Russiagate, etc. But let's welcome William Arkin to the KBOO airwaves. Welcome, William, or Bill. I'll call you Bill.
Thank you very much. You call me Bill, and thank you very much, Linda, for having me on.
Yeah, you know, I learned a lot more about researching you today than I had earlier, and I get more impressed with you. I know that's not what you're looking for, but I think I will say that. And it's important for the audience to know that you really have deep expertise in the issues of nuclear weapons and the issues of war and strategy around war, and in the issues of the changing types of warfare we're leading, and that's knowledge that's respected sort of on both sides of the of a certain divide, from the inside of the military, maybe it's no longer the military industrial intelligence complex, but from inside there and from outside there, for what you reveal to us about how these systems are really working and what they're trying to keep secret from the American public that's supposed to be their bosses.
I started in this line of work over 40 years ago as an Army intelligence analyst in West Berlin. And there, I became fascinated with national security. And when I left the Army, I said to myself, maybe I'll write a book. And really what I wanted to do and what I felt at the time was that, and this was in the late 70s, was that people were becoming more and more distant from the military, more and more distant from the national security establishment, that the creation of the all-volunteer military was making military experience more and more a segment of our population, but not something that touched everyone. And really, 40 years later, the impact of that has even seemed greater, because now I liken the perpetual war that we're in, whether that be Afghanistan, Iraq, Syria, Libya, North Africa, Yemen, Somalia, et cetera.
I believe you listed 9 countries that we've bombed this year. Yeah,
that's correct. And I liken it to wallpaper in the sense that it's everywhere and nowhere, really hard to get off, so easy to paint over. And it seemed to me that the reason why perpetual war was so resilient, and why the Obama administration wasn't really able to withdraw the United States from either Iraq or Afghanistan, was that the public was so disengaged from national security, and that the media had almost forgotten that we were at war. There was a time, I think we all remember, during the heyday of the Iraq war in the mid-2000s, when television was reporting that, oh, we've reached 2,000 American deaths, we've reached 2,500 American deaths, we've reached 3,000 American deaths. But even that became somewhat ho-hum. And now, you know, if you look at a week of news coverage on any of the networks, not just NBC, you would hardly see a story about Afghanistan or Iraq unless an American dies or unless something cataclysmic occurs.
And or perhaps there's a new president now saying he's going to withdraw a certain number of troops, and then the generals come in and say, no, not really. It seems like both of our presidents have done that.
They have done it. And I'm reluctant to say that it's the generals, because I think it's really much more a broad national security establishment that includes as many civilians as it includes generals. And it's also a Washington establishment, very much removed from the rest of the country. So when I think of perpetual war, and when I think of our now 20 years in Afghanistan, the longest war in American history, longer than the Civil War, longer than the Vietnam War, longer than World War II, I think of it as a kind of a system that keeps it going. And in fact, if you talk to people in the military, they would say to you, by and large, that they would love to get out of Afghanistan and get out of most of the fighting in the Middle East, that they think it's a diversion from what are the actual threats to the United States. And they believe that terrorism should be less of a military focus and more of a law enforcement and homeland security focus. So the military itself is not necessarily the boosters of this continuation of our warring in the Middle East. And I would defy most Americans to articulate even today what it is we're doing in these countries. I mean, what are we really doing? We have a core mission, if you will, of counterterrorism, but in reality, we're engaged in nation building, but without the conviction to actually do it or spend the money on it. We're involved in fighting even domestic enemies of the governments that we support. So in Afghanistan today, ironically, while the Afghan government is willing to share power with the Taliban and willing to sign a peace agreement, which, by the way, is the United States' official position, we're fighting the Taliban at the same time. So it's like...
It's a little crazy-making, and I think for the American public, it's very hard to keep track of, and it's not reported very often, so that I had difficulty naming. When I heard you name 9, I thought, now wait, I've got to think about this 9, who's in there? And I'd forgotten about Niger and, you know, other countries, and I think it's very hard for the American public to keep any eye on it, and then also to feel like they have any impact on it. I don't know how you feel about this, but the second Iraq war, people came out in the millions, in opposition. And I think many Americans innocently thought that their voices on the streets at that point could make a difference in stopping the war. And of course, it had no impact in stopping the second Iraq war. So I think we as the public, we don't know what to expect, and we don't know that we can have any impact. And I almost think that the media, and we'll get back to what your thoughts on warfare have to do with what's changed in the media, but I think that the media has focused more on this hyper pro-soldier kind of way of behaving, so that, you know, you almost couldn't say some soldiers do bad things over in other countries. Do you know what I'm talking about? This sort of lionization of just the regular soldier. And I think that's not because everybody believes that every soldier is great, but because this distracts us from what are those soldiers doing there and why are they there?
Well, you're raising a number of complex questions.
Yeah,
Linda, sorry. But let me just correct you for a moment.
Okay.
I think that the public opposition to the 2003 Iraq War did have an impact. That is, that it got Barack Obama elected, because Hillary Clinton, as senator, voted in favor of the Iraq War, and Barack Obama, as senator, voted against.
Oh,
and that
right.
was one of their key campaign differences. So I think that when Barack Obama promised that he would end the U.S. involvement in Iraq, it was part of why some people voted for him. Now,
I think you're right. I think they expected him to be much more anti-war, not such a proponent of imperialism.
Right. Now, in 2011, the United States indeed withdrew all of its forces from Iraq. But 3 years later, because of the disintegration of the Iraqi army, because of corruption and sectarian differences within the Iraqi government, the United States was back in Iraq to fight ISIS. And it's still there today. So I'm not sure that I would necessarily say that Barack Obama capitulated to some pressure from the national security state. But I think what was missing was that he didn't necessarily have or was able to articulate a non-war stance, how you could enhance American security while not being involved in perpetual war. I think this is where Obama's heart was. But in the absence of a strong peace movement, in the absence of strong citizen participation, in the absence of a peace party, if you will, I don't mean that with a big
P. Yeah, I understand.
Just people who want there to be a different national security for the United States. In the absence of all of those things, the truth of the matter is the war party wins. And so that's where we are today as well. And even worse, because whatever it is that the incompetent Donald Trump suggests we do, the truth of the matter is that the focus on the Trump circus and the investigation sucks all the oxygen out of the news media, and all the mainstream news media talks about is Donald Trump and the investigations. And so we, the American public, are missing out on the news media's coverage of other things, whether
yes.
it be anything, health, climate change, national security. There are only so many reporters, and there are only so many hours of the day, and when they're filled with Donald Trump sucking the oxygen out of the planet, we're just not hearing about these other things, and reporters are not being assigned to these other things because this is where the money is and this is where the attention is right now.
And that's kind of the core of your letter, which is that you really don't see a place for the kind of journalism that you think that you like to do, which is in-depth and not uncritical of the focus when you're looking at the military, that really isn't what's wanted now by larger media. I want to let the audience know that I'm speaking with Bill Arkin, William Arkin. He's a journalist. He recently quit from NBC, resigned with a letter that got outed. You wrote the letter to your colleagues, but it got leaked, which is, and it came to be called the Perpetual War Letter because of what you talked about, why you wanted to resign. And so you're sort of getting to the heart of that right now, Bill. And I want to let the audience know I also will be opening the phone lines in about another 12 or 15 minutes. That number is 503-231-8187. You might want to write that down or get yourself in line to ask questions of Bill. It's once again 503-231-8187. So, Bill, you're talking about how the media has shifted in this period and how it covers this perpetual war and war in all the different places that we're having war. I've wanted to do a little vox pox, a little take a microphone out, you know, recorder out on the street of Portland and just ask people and tell them they'll get a prize whether they get it right or not. But how many countries have we bombed this year? And just see what, you know, the people on the street actually know about this. I think they would not think it would be more than even four. So, talk about the role that you feel the media has been playing in this and how it's connected to and in what ways it's literally hiring. I believe, haven't they recently hired John Brennan at CNN as an analyst? This is a man that I first remember coming to my intelligence because of his comments and his work with Yemen to destabilize Yemen, I would say, is what he was really about there, but calling it a power without a government, et cetera. So, he's now part of the media. So can you talk about this change in the media that's resulted in a replacement of other experts on air with military and intelligence personnel, literally?
Well, so again, when we speak about the mainstream media, we speak about the two loci of the mainstream media, which is New York and Washington.
I kind of include NPR. I just want to let you know that. I consider them very mainstream.
Well,
I watch them.
Okay, that's fine.
And yeah, I just wanted to throw it in there.
So when you think of them, you think how cut off they are from the rest of the country. And the aesthetic that they follow in covering the news is obviously both what is going on in Washington and also what appeals to those who live in those places. And so intrinsically, the mainstream media is already blinkered. It's already a little bit of out of whack with what the American public at large is interested in. And then you have this phenomena of almost 20 years of war. And it's complicated and it's opaque because it is warfare, so there's a lot of secrecy involved, and that is why the mainstream media has sought the assistance of former CIA directors, retired generals and admirals, et cetera, to be commentators and analysts, and mostly I think that when they actually comment and analyze about things that they know, it is a useful addition. But what's missing is the other side. We've almost forgotten that there is a peace constituency in America. We've forgotten that there's an academic community which is filled with people who are critical of American foreign policy and the conduct of warfare. And you hardly see them on television anymore, and you hardly see them quoted in the mainstream media. So, it's,
you know, Bill, let me add something on to what you're saying. There is, being in part of the independent media, we hear from people like from the Institute for Fairness and Accuracy and all sorts of other things that when we interview them, they're no longer being interviewed on almost all other media, unless it's an independent, literally independent, probably community. We're volunteer supported, not getting any kind of commercial dollars. They're not finding anywhere for their expertise to be on the air. You know, we get a lot of people on the air just because they're not heard elsewhere. They might have gone to a bigger media outlet. We're a pretty small outlet, but
yeah,
they're just not there.
Yeah, and that is a phenomenon that I think has many tentacles to it. It's about who is important to the reporters, So these former generals, admirals, and government officials are sources for the reporters, and so there's a bit of a cushy relationship between them. It's also who is presentable on TV. I've often said to my colleagues in the news media, look, if there's an academic out there that's brilliant on a subject and they're not good on television, let's teach them how to be good on television. It's that simple. You know, it's that simple, but we just don't. And particularly right now, we're in a crisis in the news media because Donald Trump has sucked so much oxygen out of the planet. And so, therefore, it's really the only thing that the mainstream can talk about. Now, I don't just mean NBC. I mean all of the networks and CNN. I mean all of the newspapers. It's really all the same. And it includes now all of the internet media outlets, whether that be Politico or Vox or BuzzFeed or The Daily Beast, they're all essentially fighting for the same ears, the same eyeballs. They're fighting for the same readership. And ironically, though we thought maybe a decade or two ago that the internet was going to be the great leveler, that the internet was going to somehow democratize the news media. The truth of the matter is that the BuzzFeeds of the world are just as much driven by having to make a profit and having to make money as is NBC. And so we've seen in the last year that BuzzFeed and others have fired large numbers of journalists. I think BuzzFeed fired 5 to 10% of its news staff within the last 6 months. Breitbart, even the right-wing, the right-wing.com news service is losing money left and right now. And so there is an economic factor there. And I'm afraid that we haven't quite created news media in the public interest. What was really intended with the FEC's control of the airwaves was what was really intended with the sort of Hippocratic oath of journalism, which is to operate in the public sphere and in the public good. I'm afraid we sort of have fallen down as social media and as the internet has become more and more ubiquitous. And I'm hoping that we will return to an era in which the news media really does see its role as a broader educator of the public and a broader informer of the public. Right now, I just see it as being very limited in the menu that it provides to the listeners and to the viewers.
And, yes, and much of the
needs to be much bigger.
Much of the style has changed as well, which means, you know, precious air moments are taken up with stories that are meant to make us feel good or make us, you know, feel inspired about somebody's plight or trouble. News shows, news broadcasts have really become much more like a sort of news hour, which means that they talk about a lot of things that aren't necessarily news and the amount of actually. But at the same time, we've broadened how many different kinds of outlets. If you look at blogs and podcasts and YouTube, there are out there, which I think one of the most interesting things that's been happening, and we can't go into it in depth here, but is about how advertisers have been able to use these newly developed AI systems, logarithms that continuously feed back on us as individuals and try to feed us what we would want to hear and yet the message they would want to give us. And so we're being manipulated in ways that most of us don't want to admit exist, though there wouldn't be advertising if it didn't work well. They're all making money, those advertisers, not necessarily the bigger entities. And so I think we've come in an interestingly complex and not complex time, in the sense the sort of dumbing down of what used to be called news and turning it more into entertainment, and at the same time way, way, way more little things blinking to draw our eye.
Well, I think that you're right in many ways, and I don't want to be completely negative because, as I said to you before, I did think that public involvement has an impact, as we saw with the election of Barack Obama. I want to also say that the downside is something that should really alarm people in terms of our understanding and getting a handle over social media, because that elected Donald Trump. And yes. So social media and this phenomena of its both influence and importance within our society, I liken it to a technology that's just in its infancy, that we haven't figured out really how to what the rules are and how we should behave inside social media. And I imagine over the next years and decades, we'll see many changes in the nature. And I note that many of the Democratic candidates, Elizabeth Warren and others, have been arguing that there needs to be a monopoly breakup of social media, that Google and Facebook and others have become too powerful. And I think that there's probably some truth to that. But I think what it ignores, if we solely focus on the woes of the news media, if we solely focus on the crimes of the mainstream, we're ignoring the absence of civic education and civic life in America. And so, yes, it's true that you at KBOO have your listeners and volunteers and a vibrant community, but overall, civic life in America is in crisis. And if people don't learn about civics in high school and in college, if we don't practice good citizenship in our day-to-day lives, then we really have very little to complain about, because we end up having the government that we deserve, if you will. And I'm myself very focused right now in writing a book on how to end perpetual war, on the fact that there needs to be greater civic education and greater civilian literacy when it comes to national security, because I truly believe that that's the way in which we are going to have an influence to make changes.
Well, I'm excited about the book, and I look forward to it coming out. I want to let the audience out there now know it's now your chance to call in. That we're going to open the phone lines. The number to call is 503-231-8187. Call in with your questions and your concerns. Speak to Bill directly about the issues he's been bringing up. I will continue to bring up other issues as we go along. But when you call, we'll try to get you on right away. Bill, I know you recently wrote an article for The Guardian, and you've been a U.S. columnist for The Guardian for a while, I believe, because I saw some older articles. This one was on Korea, and I was really happy to see you writing on Korea, because I've been so very frustrated by the coverage of what's been going on. One of the things that I felt strongly was irritated at the Democratic Party that seemed to not want to have denuclearization and did not seem to be paying attention to the people of South Korea and North Korea, who seem to very much want reunification, and that would require the U.S. Not being in between, so to speak. And so let's talk about Korea and the media and the way it covers it, and what you were trying to do with your articles that's different from that.
Well, the Korean Peninsula is a perfect example of where we have news and we have analysis which is divorced from results. So what do we want in Korea? We don't want just perpetually to have this nation divided and to have militarized domination of everything on the Korean Peninsula. We want eventually for there to be peace. We want eventually for there to be reunification. We want eventually for there to be nuclear disarmament. And so when you divorce a coverage of Korea from the questions of what your ultimate goals are, it seems to me that you end up with everybody basically saying the same thing, which in the era of Donald Trump was, oh my God, this crazy man is going to give away the store, and somehow that's going to make things more dangerous. When I think what people should have said and felt, and this is what I wrote, was that, wait, if Donald Trump thinks that he can achieve denuclearization. And if Donald Trump wants to pursue better relations with North Korea, and if we can find the incentives by which we can open up North Korea economically, socially, in terms of communications or media, that eventually is going to result in the demise of North Korea, because like East Germany, the people are going to start to see more clearly what the advantages of the West are, and what the advantages of the international system are, what the advantages of democracy are, and perhaps we could work over decades, as it took in East Germany, to create a movement to change the government and to ultimately reunify the country. And it seemed to me like that goal, which was so obvious, that goal was not even part of the discussion or the lexicon of what was going on in Korea, and that people were missing what was happening in terms of the dialogue between the North and South. They were missing the possibility that Donald Trump had done something that was so unorthodox that he had opened the door for there to be a different solution. And as soon as that summit broke down in Vietnam, you know, the national security establishment was right back in there saying, well, see, North Korea is not ever going to give up its nukes. Donald Trump is not real, and he's not for real. And we just need to go back to the old days of accepting that North Korea is going to have a nuclear arsenal, and now we need to build up our own capabilities to sanction them, to deter them, to coerce them. And that is just going back into the 20-year history since the early 90s, when North Korea began to develop nuclear weapons, of just the confrontation method. And I was just arguing, why can't we see it in a different way? And in fact, I was arguing that there were so many things that had already happened, that North Korea had ceased nuclear testing, that North Korea had stopped shooting off long-range missiles, that the United States and North Korea had reduced tensions just by taking small measures of stopping military exercises, of not having ships so close to the peninsula, of not having bomber flights flying from Guam over North Korea, that both sides had done all of these little confidence-building measures that had already shown to be having a result in reducing the tensions between the two sides, which was opening the way for the South and the North to be talking. And yet it wasn't a part of the news of understanding what was going on in Korea, that it was purely one argument, which was, is Donald Trump crazy or isn't he crazy? And it was purely one argument, which was, why would Kim ever want to give up his nuclear weapons? Because without nuclear weapons, there would be no Kim Jong-un and his regime. And so therefore, that skepticism really drove the entirety of the news coverage of the Korean story.
I actually felt like it was almost like the media was howling for war instead of for peace. I mean, they just really, I even heard one reporter, I swear they were conflating Kim I'll never get his name right. I know I say that wrong. Kim Jong-un's father and him. They were like saying that they were exactly the same leader. And therefore, you know, and I think they actually literally conflated some of the things his father did and said that he had done them. There was such a drive to portray him as, you know, something so virulent that we wouldn't want to have anything to do with him in the media here. We do have a caller, though, so let's get him on the line. His name is George. George, you're on the air.
Good morning.
Thanks
thank
for calling.
Thank you for bringing Bill Arkin on the air. And I just wanted to mention very briefly that I seem to be remembering something I read in a book, and I looked up the original essay by Walter Lippmann after World War One, saying that a transformation had occurred, that the advertisers and the military people had gotten into finding out how they could manipulate the public into more war and more war. And I wondered if William Arkin has, I would suspect he's read the essay by Walter Lippmann, and I can't find it on my shelf now, but I read it.
Well, Walter Lippmann is not the only one. Thank you, caller, for bringing up the cushy relationship which exists in the elite. But let's bring it up to date, because we no longer really have a military-industrial complex anymore. Now, the vast majority of the defense budget, the vast majority of the national security budget is information. And so it may be true that aircraft carriers and bombers and fighter jets are more expensive than they have ever been, and in fact they are, but the truth is that the vast majority of our national security budget goes towards people and information. And so today you would have to more accurately describe it as kind of a military information intelligence contractor complex. And that makes it also much more difficult to wrap your hands around it. So the industrial part of it has become less and less important. Now, what most people wouldn't really understand is that because information has become more and more important to the defense establishment and to the national security establishment, the information companies, and I mean now everyone from Verizon to Microsoft to Amazon, are key players in national security. Amazon runs the cloud for the intelligence community. Microsoft, Dell, these companies make hundreds of millions of dollars off of the military, which is the largest employer in the United States and the most important part of the federal budget. And so you do have this undeniable relationship. Now, the question is, does it itself influence what our policies are? Do these entities themselves influence? And I'm afraid that I would have to probably say no, that I think that it's so embedded within our society. As Linda said, it's embedded in even the news media coverage and how monofocused it is and how singular the issues are. It's so embedded in the lexicon of our day-to-day lives that to say that some entity is a bad actor that is keeping war going, I'm saying to you, no, war is being kept going because the American population doesn't seem to care, doesn't seem to be interested, and doesn't seem to be involved. And so here we are in 2019, and we're about to build a next generation of nuclear weapons at the cost of hundreds of billions of dollars, a program which was given support and funding all during the Barack Obama administration, and yet we hardly have an anti-nuclear movement in America anymore. We hardly have a peace movement in America anymore. And so if you want to cede the territory to the military intelligence information contractor complex, if you want to cede it to them, then they're going to do what they do. It's really important that the citizenry get more involved in this. I don't think that there's a nefarious actor. I think what there is a vacuum of civilian control of the military.
I wanted to thank you. This is a very enlightening essay you are presenting. Very. Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
You know, and if you are a computer user, you can Google William Arkin, and I click on the tab up above News, and you can get a whole lot of information about other things that he's written, and and go to those sources and read them yourself. Bill, and thank you, George, for calling in. I want to give that number again. It's 503-231-8187. Call in and ask your questions, state your opinions. We're wanting to hear from you now. I wanted to go back to the article that you wrote on Korea. And I think that there were a couple. Well, one, I'll bring up one other thing. What I noticed in the coverage was that I knew something had happened. You know, Bolton and Pompeo had gone with him. Bolton would like to drop a bomb in anything that could mean peace. He generally is extremely hawkish and tries to destroy things is my main view of him, which is probably not fair. But Bolton and Pompeo went along, and all of a sudden the summit was over, and I thought, what happened? And I couldn't really tell what I thought happened, but I heard his name is Nick Schifrin, I believe. He is, I see him on NPR, and he was the only reporter I heard who said this, and maybe you can validate whether this happened or not, but he said that they offered additional conditions to Kim, that they said to him that he not only had to denuclearize entirely, but he also had to reveal and get rid of any chemical, and I think there was one other kind of weapons that he might have. And those were two new agreements, and all of that had to be done before there could be sanctions at all removed, not even some. And I believe that during the Clinton era, there was a sort of a back and forth wheel. And you've pointed out that there, in actuality, behind the scenes, there has been a lot of give and take between North Korea and the U.S. And under Clinton, I believe the sanctions were tied to you pull back this much, we'll stop this sanction, you do this, we'll stop that sanction. But this thing with Bolton and Pompeo about that you have to also reveal any chemical weapons you have and destroy all those, and all of it has to happen before any sanctions are removed. I think that was just a let's go break the deal. Let's go make it not happen. And did you hear anything about that?
Well, I think that you're being unfair, okay. And yet at the same time, it doesn't matter. Because here's the truth.
Okay.
The truth is that the preparation for the Korean summit and the nature of the Trump administration was so slapdash that it wasn't really destined to be a success, even if it hadn't been interrupted and stopped. It was not destined to be a success because, first of all, the Trump administration is not well prepared on anything. We see that in the last couple of days with the defunding of the Special Olympics and then the refunding of the Special Olympics. They just don't know what they're doing. And then second, I think what happened in the case of Korea was that the national security bureaucracy and the national security establishment wasn't really behind what it was that the president was doing. And so therefore, I don't blame Bolton and Pompeo per se, because there are thousands of arms controllers and thousands of subject matter experts and experts behind the president when he goes to a summit. And essentially, if they're not supportive of what the president wants to do, if they're the permanent government that essentially thinks either they are protecting the United States from Donald Trump or that they know better. And so let's be very clear about what we expect from our government, okay? Some liberals think, oh my God, thank God that the CIA and the FBI are protecting us from Donald Trump. And I'm saying to you, that's the wrong way to look at it. The right way to look at it is that if Elizabeth Warren becomes president or Bernie Sanders becomes president, are these same permanent people going to decide that they need to protect the nation from them as well? And so if you are lauding the role that somehow these agencies of the government, that's all they are, agencies of the government are doing in protecting the nation, then you're feeding a notion that that's what they should be doing, that they themselves think that that's their role. And it's not their role. Their role is to protect and defend the Constitution. Now, whether you like it or not, the Constitution it creates a president, and we have him as president, and the government should be supporting Donald Trump as president. But now it's Donald Trump, and he hates the government, and he hates his own government, and he fights in wars with the Justice Department and with the State Department and with other agencies. And so when you think of this government and you think that somehow they're doing God's work and protecting the United States from Donald Trump, I just warn you as citizens that if Bernie Sanders becomes president or Cory Booker or Elizabeth Warren or some other liberal who might want to have peace, might want to have a reduction in defense spending, and might want to have a very different foreign policy, you are going to have to deal with the fact that we have created a permanent government and a permanent national security establishment that sees their role as stopping change.
Yeah, so you talk about the stagnancy,
anything else.
The stagnancy of the whole thing that doesn't really have a strategic outlook about what are we doing in all these countries? Why are we doing all this war? I do feel like that the profit taking off of all of this, even the new information era, has to be a large part of why this continues to perpetuate, no matter. You know, a lot of people ask me, who are you going to vote for president? Who are you going to vote for president? And one year I traded a friend of mine a vote for something I wanted, and I agreed to vote for Obama. But I have failed to vote for presidents. You may disagree with this, Bill, because I felt that the continuity of the kinds of policies that have come out of Washington with regard to imperialism, with regard to now what of over 800 bases militarily around the world, at the cost of any investment in people. My streets of Portland are filled with people living on the streets at a much larger level than I've ever seen anywhere in my life. And it continues only to grow while we, quote, have a good economy. I have to think that money plays a large part in this and in its role of manipulating us. But my main point was, I don't care. I'm with you. I don't think who we get in power as an individual is going to change that ongoing trajectory of more and more money, effort, and stuff put into this larger war. Maybe it's information complex and very little into the lives and livelihood of the people of America.
Well, they're certainly not going to do it if you don't vote.
Well, I hear that, and I get a lot of arguments, but I vote for the local things, not the national.
And they're certainly not going to do it if people don't engage in civics and in civic life.
And I do that. I do.
I want to say, though, that it does matter who's president.
Okay, tell me how. Tell me how.
Well, we're seeing it right now. We're seeing it right now. So, well, it matters in the sense that absent any kind of direction from the top, and we do have an executive system, absent adequate oversight from Congress, and we do have a balance of power, then the government runs itself. And that is true. But I didn't say that that meant that there wasn't a possibility of a different system. It just meant that we had spent too many years accepting that the government ran itself, particularly in the national security field. And so Congress has failed to provide adequate oversight, and the executive has failed to provide a strategy or a grand vision for America's role in the world that guides the national security establishment. But there's a third group that's failed, and that is the American public has failed to engage in such a way that makes it clear to both its elected leaders, whether that be in Congress or in Washington, of what they want. And so I feel like though you may agree with my analysis that the national security community is way too powerful, and you might agree with my insights as to how it is that they have thwarted the will of the American people as expressed in our elected officials, the truth of the matter is that that's not a license to resign. It's not a license to say, well, because they have this power, I don't need to involve myself anymore. It's actually more of an invitation for greater involvement. And so I say to you, Linda, we're not going to argue about it.
Oh, no.
You have to vote. Because I say it to my kids, and I say it to young adults who I mentor, that you have to vote. You just have to do it. It's a citizen obligation. It's not a choice.
And, well, you know, I think I agree with you. In general, and I have felt that way in general. I know that, you know, our votes here in Portland have recently brought us Joanne Hardesty, a longtime KBOO host, but more than that, she's been a longtime community activist, an African-American woman who's been a real police accountability activist as whether as many things. And her being in office has already, I mean, within the first few months, she made several major changes just as a member of the city council. So I do believe in civic involvement and in trying to change things. I guess I find it hard. There's a little thing about cognitive dissonance. Voting for someone that you really oppose and dislike is very hard for me to do. But I hear what you're saying. I do believe that we need to try to make our voices heard on what we believe is important and what course we want our nation to take in the world as a whole. So on that point, I think we do strongly agree. I want to tell people out there, I'm speaking with Bill Arkin. He is a journalist. He is an author. He is an expert on military issues and on nuclear war, nuclear issues, and has been writing for the many different vehicles, but NBC and MSNBC is a consultant and an author. And also you can find him right now in The Guardian as a U.S. Consultant will call in and talk about this thing of perpetual war. And while you're preparing to call at 503-231-8187, I'll ask Bill, what are you hoping to do in these years now that you've left? I know you're writing two books and maybe you could talk about those, but you're hoping to and impact this perpetual war and try to find a way to impact how the American public sees perpetual war and interacts with society in being able to get away from this. But mostly you want to impact media also in terms of how it has a role in perpetual war. Why don't you talk about what you're hoping to do in this time going forward?
Well, first and foremost is I want to think. So we don't put a lot of value on that. And I want to think about, and that's what I'm doing, why has perpetual war become so resilient and non-ending? I want to think about freshly as much as I can. What are the powers behind what happens, and how did they gain power, and how can that balance be recreated between not just the branches of government, but between Washington and the rest of the country? So this is something that has seized me for almost a decade now. I wrote a book and a long series of articles in the Washington Post in 2010 on Top Secret America, which looked at the growth of this community after 9/11. And now we're approaching the 20th anniversary, Linda. It's coming up just in a couple of years, the 20th anniversary. Do you know that this September, for the first time ever, 18-year-olds will be able to join the military who were born after 9/11.
Wow, I hadn't really thought about that. Not after Vietnam anymore, is it?
No, it's after 9/11. So on September 11th, 2019, 18-year-olds who were born after 9/11 will be able to join the military. So the nature of the military, the nature of the country has changed. And I'm trying to wrap my head around understanding what that means. So there's a smaller and smaller segment of our population that is directly engaged in and influenced by the defense budget. And yet everyone is indirectly influenced by it, because if it's eating up 70% of the discretionary spending of the federal government, and overall, if the national security establishment is spending over $1 trillion a year now between Defense Department, Homeland Security, Veterans Affairs, the intelligence community, the FBI, et cetera, then this is a lot of money that's going into something. Now, what is that something? The something is supposed to be our security. And yet, if you can say to me today, 18 years after 9/11, that there's not one country in the Middle East that's safer than it was in 2001, that there's not one country on the planet that can say that it is safer than it was in 2001, then something is wrong with the prosecution of our national security establishment. They need to be held accountable for the results. And the result, in my mind, is that we do not say ever, oh, this year we have better security than last year, and that the spending and the effort, therefore, is worth it. It's almost as if we are completely and utterly divorced from the result in terms of what it is that goes into the making of our national security.
I think that's a really, really important point. And I know that I like that what you want to do is think, because I think that is one of the hardest things to do with the mass of information coming our way. I personally have withdrawn from Facebook except to promote programs that I'm doing, but I've withdrawn from it because, you know, I got tired of being fed that same old horse video that I always liked and would spend a second on. And I didn't like feeling that every click I made was being recorded somewhere and said to mean something about me that they could then use to sell me something back at. Not that I was important to these, but that's the way that it operates has really bothered me. We've had so many revelations about the secrets that are kept by our nation and the secret agreements between our nation and, like you were mentioning, Amazon, Google, all of those. How do you see in the future the importance of us finding out the ways that the security state is operating with regard to us?
Well, I think it's crucially important that the public and the news media play a larger and larger role in holding the government accountable. But we also have to think, as we go down that road, what is it that we're holding them accountable for? What are we trying to get? And so there's like the 1980s model of government accountability, and it's all about making sure that things cost less and that they operate properly. It's kind of a legacy, if you will, of the industrial era. So some journalists and some citizens see fraud, waste, and abuse within the federal budget as the way in which you hold the government accountable. But I'm saying to you that I really do think it's a 1980s model, and that we need to update this model to a broader accountability agenda. And that broader accountability agenda is really about, does the government produce the results that it purports to be working towards? And in the field of national security, it's a very difficult place to make an assessment and to come to a conclusion, because most people feel like they don't have the expertise to do so. Most people feel like they can't get to the true information. And indeed, I would even argue that there is obviously an interest on the part of those who run the nut house to keep the nut house out of anybody else's hands. So I do believe that. I mean, when I hear the Department of Homeland Security say that 10 terrorists a day are trying to get into the United States, part of me says, really? You want me to believe that? and the other part of me says, oh, that's pretty good fundraising. Right? That's pretty good fundraising.
Fundraising for the trillion dollars to go to the military.
Yes.
Well, Bill, thank you so much for today. I've been speaking with Bill Arkin, journalist with NBC, who resigned and wrote an important letter that has been called the Perpetual War Letter. You can look that up on Google. He's also the author of Top Secret America, one of the most important books that revealed to us what's really happening behind the national security state and how they operate. Thank you so much for joining us here on KBOO, Bill Arkin. Your show will be archived shortly after this today, and people can tune in and listen to it at their will after that. And now we've got to move on.
Thank you, Linda, very much for having me on.
You're welcome. Thank you for joining us.